going to sneeze.
What? Never mind. I thought I was going to sneeze. I didn't want you to go deaf.
You have your mic on? Oh, yeah, I do. Okay.
Yeah, I think everyone's on.
Okay. All right. Hello.
When he says your name, you can say hi.
I'm going to say henlo.
Hello.
No, henlo, like a burb. Henlo.
Okay, it's recording. So go ahead.
Hello, and welcome to State of the Revolution. I'm Leon O'Sheeran. My co-host today is Samuel Klein.
Hi.
This week, we'll be talking to Ryan Basor, a cannabis activist here in Michigan and a member of the Okemo 7. But first, let's talk about some news. I want to talk today about the protests going on in Paris over the last, Paris and actually across France over the last week and more. They're really getting out in the streets and we talk about mudslinging over here. I saw images of the Paris protesters in Paris hosing down government buildings with literally a shit hose. Dousing their government in manure. I believe that's a pretty clear statement about what they think. Have you been following this, Sam? What's your takeaway from there?
I have. I think that it's been very interesting to kind of see what's been happening with the French people, just especially given some of the stark similarities and differences between the way that they feel culturally about activism and politics and the way that they feel responsible for the actions of their government in juxtaposition to the way that we do. And this goes back all the way to the founding of both of our nations, or in France, it would be like the Fifth Republic. I think that it's shown effectiveness, and I think that there's a lot of desire to have some of those outcomes replicated, if not the amount of determination and work.
What do you mean by that? I'm not quite sure.
I just think that the French people have a lot more confidence. They have this track record of understanding that it can work. France made the guillotine famous for a reason.
Right.
And I think that that is part of just the cultural background knowledge that is being brought up.
So what you mean is that culturally they have a history of, if we all get together and stand up to the government, we can actually make the government change. Is that what you're talking about? So they have that,
yes,
that history, and so they have the confidence that they can do that, and they're much more likely to go out and do that. They've done a lot more of that kind of stuff in recent history, certainly than we have in the U.S.
Yeah, and again, from my limited perspective as an American who just likes reading, French news in French to, you know, keep sharp there, I guess. I think that there's this interesting subtle trait of being able to have these protests and this discontent and this disgruntlement without being hateful and spiteful. One of the most famous videos that I've seen spreading around is the Yellow Vest protest, and they, you know, shut down a main road. And they actually dragged out a piano, and they were protesting, and they were also having fun. They were, taking turns playing the piano while also keeping their prerogative of making sure that traffic can't cross and that they are seen,
right,
and that people ask questions and that people are inconvenienced.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is such a stark contrast to the American context, where... Mm-hmm. Where people who protest in public assembly, they're not just using their right to petition the government. They're not using their right to assembly. They are, they're anarchists, and they're trying to, destroy America, and they're trying to destroy, 250 years of freedom. They're trying to go against everything, not just the government, not just a bad policy, not just a bad politician. They are trying to go against the framing of it in America, is these people are malcontents, and they are outcasts, and they are ostracized, and they are trying to to deconstruct everything that you do and everything that we are.
So, the actual story is that you get protests like this when democracy breaks down, when you have a situation of, for example, 17% of the population elects 52 senators, and you have the money primary, and you have gerrymandering, and you have voter suppression, and all of this kind of stuff. The fact that we don't have more protests like this, where people are standing up and saying, "Hey, you promised us a democracy. You tell us it's a democracy all the time, but it's obviously not. And we need to change that because there are people dying because of it. There are people dying because millionaires and billionaires want to pay less in taxes and don't want to contribute to the public good, to the common good and the public interest." I agree that that's the that with what you said about how it's framed in the media. Yeah. But we really have to keep our eyes on the ball here because we have centuries of propaganda about American democracy. We export that propaganda, but look at what's happening. Whether it's the lame duck that we're going to talk about in a little bit in Michigan and Wisconsin, or whether it's the way that the House is gerrymandered, or the Senate is deliberately undemocratic.
Yeah.
So that's when you get these kind of protests, and I think we should have more of them in the U.S. We need to have more people stand up and say, this is not acceptable. And I would argue in every way that we possibly can, including blocking traffic, at the very least.
Yeah. And I think that that's something that isn't as attractive for the news cycle, especially the news cycle that makes it over and is translated into English. Mm-hmm. The pictures that I've seen have been the man playing the piano with the yellow vest.
Sure.
Or a piece of graffiti that says, "Down with caviar, long live the kebab."
Right.
And those are funny, they're lighthearted, they're wholesome almost.
Right.
Just in terms of people rallying around something that they believe in.
Sure.
But there's also the side that is quite revolutionary and quite violent. There's firebombs, there's cars being torn open, there's barricades, there's mm-hmm. There's literal manure hoses being sprayed onto municipal buildings.
Right.
And I think that boils down to, why are people protesting in America, in France? How do you change that? And how will that make more people who currently don't believe in protest more likely to? Is it being malcontent? Is it being spiteful and hateful?
And hateful is saying that you don't get to have health care unless you can pay for it. That's being spiteful and hateful. I'm just saying that that idea that people standing up and saying, "Hey, the system isn't working for us, and we're not being and you're not paying attention to us in the normal ways that we're supposed to go about this through the electoral process, etc." When you have a situation where people are not having their living in a society that is not addressing the issues that the majority of people are dealing with. I think it is taking the authoritarian side to start talking about, "Oh, that's spiteful and hateful that they're blocking traffic." No, they're blocking traffic so that the people who are not as deeply affected as the majority of people are by the inequalities in our system, are being asked to pay attention to this, and we're not just asking; we're causing disruption and causing inconvenience in order to get the message across.
And that's the exact same message that I would want to be passed on to organizers in America. Mm-hmm. Not just when you're organizing rallies, not just when you're giving speeches with a megaphone, mm-hmm. but when you're thinking about it, what am I going to do tomorrow, while you're saying your prayers to George Soros before you go to bed? How do you message it? Is it that, or is it, is the messaging more effective when you internalize it and when you speak about it, not as being hateful, it's legitimate, but I think fundamentally incorrect to people. Mm-hmm. I think that it's legitimate to take people's anger and their wrath and their discontent and demobilize it, but it's also not all negative and destructive. There's also this positivity, this aspect of mm-hmm. I want to hold France or America or my local government in Lansing accountable to everything that we all aspire it to be.
Right. I absolutely agree. And but here's the thing. One of the things that you see in France is you have a much lower key police response, okay, than you often see in America. Not that their police response is not still in many ways over the top, but the way that the authorities in America react to these kinds of things is tempered by, you know, that difference in culture. And unfortunately, that ends up meaning that you often have a very violent response that makes it much harder to have a movement that's going out there and having those kinds of positive messages that you're talking about because of that backlash. And I think that's something that that's hard. There's people that do trainings on how to participate in that kind of a situation with the police overreaction and not end up with that kind of negativity or keep yourself calm and have a plan. And I think that's an important aspect of that. We need to bring more of that in, but let's also be clear that if the authorities want to have a more amicable protest, you know, and when I say amicable, I'm not talking about that we're being passive. You know, there is protest that isn't passive. We learned how to have non-passive protest. That's also non-violent protest from Gandhi and King, among others. But I think that we have this situation where the authorities tend to drive a harder response, and we need to work on how we deal with that. What do you think about that? Do you think that that's something that you've seen, or?
To a degree, I think. I'd wanna sit on that a little bit more and just just see what pops up later.
Okay. Okay, I want to move on to some other news items, but I also want to point out that some of what you're hearing about what these protesters want is not right. I mean, for example, they put out a list of about 42 different items. Number 22 on the list is a maximum salary fixed at 15,000 euros. I'm assuming that's a month, I believe, which is about a little bit more than 10 times what they said the minimum wage should be. A little bit more. They said the minimum wage, that's item number 3, is 1,300 euros, and no pension should be less than 1,200. So they're basically saying, you know, nobody should be making more than 10 times what anybody else makes. Because nobody's time and effort and energy is worth 10 times more than what somebody else's is worth. I'm not saying I don't know that that's their because, but I think that that's an interesting way of looking at it, because we often highly overvalue, CEOs and things like that, even when they trash their companies, still get golden parachutes.
Yeah. So, and they get severance packages when everyone else gets left out. Yeah. I think that's a really common strategy for demands. They have 42 demands here. Same thing for a lot of big demand lists. BLM comes to mind. Mm-hmm. There's a very large list, and it's a negotiation tactic. And both sides know that not all of those demands are going to be met. But you aim high, so that when you get into negotiation, more goes through. If you only need it listed 5 demands, you might only get 3 of them.
Right.
I think that's why it would be put in. And they do go into a lot of detail about disabled benefits and about pensions and the SICE tax.
Right. And it's a really interesting list. I recommend that people take a look at it, and we'll have the link in the show notes. Mm-hmm. So I also wanted to talk about led by Bernie Sanders, the Senate, despite the fact it is currently controlled by Republicans, voted by a significant margin to end support for the war in Yemen, end support for the Saudis currently conducting this war in Yemen. First of all, you can say what you want about all of the other people that are talking about running for president, but you know, here's Sanders demonstrating that he can bring people together on an important issue and get a positive result, despite the fact that Speaker Ryan over in the House is a consummate coward and won't let this come to a vote there. Hopefully, after January, when the Democrats take control of the House, we can get a vote from both houses of the legislature. Thoughts on this?
I think that the cycle of Congress is somewhat important to note. I actually don't know the answer to this, but I'd be really curious to figure out if this was introduced and brought to committee and brought back very quickly after Khashoggi, or if this was something that had been in the works for a little while. I can definitely see Senator Sanders making this legislation a while ago, and it just picking up traffic in the news cycle with all of the news around Yemen and Saudi Arabia more recently.
Right.
And I think that, granted, Speaker Ryan, you know, has been called a coward many times for good reason, and I don't know if they have the time left in this session of Congress to pass it, just because they're probably all on Christmas leave right about now, and they won't get back together until after the new year. So even if the Speaker had been inclined to try to push this into a vote, just logistically with the way that the schedule of the House of Representatives is set up, it might not have gone. And then it definitely wouldn't have gone through the president.
Well, so the thing is that I don't give that much of the benefit of the doubt there, because I've seen so many times when if it's something that's really important to them, they'll make sure it gets in under the wire, you know. So I don't buy that argument, the fact that Trump won't sign it, I still want them to pass it. I want the world to see that it's not just the Senate, that it's really just a few people who happen to be in key positions of power right now, who are behind this now, who are behind continuing that conflict, in a way that, you know, it's a humanitarian disaster. It's you know, killing vast numbers of people, that, you know, children and people that are completely innocent in all of this. And, you know, that kind of behavior across the world, unfortunately, unless we change the way that we do politics, unless we change the way that we do energy, unless we change the way that we handle the environment, we're going to have more and more and more of these things. We need to start building a record of standing up against them and being able to shut them down, whether or not the president cooperates or has to be overridden.
So that's interesting, when you talk about standing up to them, mm-hmm. them assumedly being, you know, people that are warmongering and profiteering. Mm-hmm. I think that that's this interesting duality that America's dealt with for a while. You know, number one, wanting to pull out of Iraq and Afghanistan and Yemen and Vietnam and Korea, and the list goes back and back, while also, you know, wanting to say, we'll stand up for this. We're not going to allow human rights abuses. We're not going to allow, you know, the indiscriminate killing of families and children and civilians. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, almost on the opposite hand in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's just something that we'll have to see play out in this situation. I, for one, I'm okay with Speaker Ryan holding off, just because come January, they won't have to have a down vote and another process. Hopefully they'll put it through and the House will pass it, and it will have both chambers of Congress signing off on it and having it go to the president with that much more pressure. I don't want to give the ammunition of this failed a vote or this wasn't important enough to go to a vote. You know, I want to see it pass through, and if that means waiting until January, so that the president has more public pressure and less ammunition to backfire on, then I'll take that.
Well, I would be perfectly happy if it failed in the current House and then came back in January and passed it. I mean, that's just another emphasis on the difference between Democrats and Republicans. As much as I criticize the Democratic Party, and they've well deserved a ton of it, you know, there are differences. you know, again, also in this area, the criticism of the Democratic Party for support for various different wars that we could go into in detail. But, you know, so it's not like it's a clean break or anything like that. But at least on this particular issue, we can show that there is a difference. And I'm in favor of that. Not because of any partisanship or anything like that, but because it's an important voice that the American people have. We voted, just in November, by more than 9 million votes, the House and the Senate, votes for, House and Senate by more than 9 million votes voted, favored Democrats, despite the fact that the Republicans, because the states are in fact themselves a gerrymander, are still going to retain control of the Senate this January. But, I want to see Republicans take votes that show what they're about, and I want Democrats to take votes that show what they're about. And I'm really glad that Sanders was able to force this through, and so you can see where your senators are and which and how many of them are in favor of a war-induced famine that's killing children, carried out by a murderous regime that they claim we have to continue to maintain relationships with because we want to sell them machines of war and we want to buy from them oil that is literally killing the planet. And that's we need to make it clear and stark what's going on and who's in favor of what. So I'm in favor of any time we can make that point clear.
Yeah, I think that, and I think the action from the speaker to not put it to a vote, that in a different way, but also an important way, tells the way that the party is about that issue. That also sends the same message, and that's what Senator Sanders said, is that I don't think that he believes that this will make it through and the president will sign off on it.
Right.
It was more for the message of it. And
sure.
I think that, if anything, we can take the silence of the House of Representatives and Speaker Ryan as a counterpoint to that message.
Absolutely. And we need to hang it around their necks, you know, as heavily and as often as possible, because, it's just well beyond the pale, and the fact that we don't feel it that much here across the country is a result of too much rhetoric to tamp down. You know, don't pay attention to that. Don't look at what's going on over there. We need to be able to make these arms sales. I mean, what kind of a ridiculous argument?
Yeah. Fun fact, though. OPEC actually has the U.S. listed in the top three for export profits right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't even use that as an excuse of we need to play nice because we need oil. I think that that's gone too. It's just that we don't care.
Right. I mean, we're certainly producing a lot of fuel. Again, you know, regardless of where it's produced, the fact that we burn it is what's causing a tremendous amount of our climate change problem. Until we get that under control, nobody should get a pass for anything that takes us farther down that road. So speaking of holding people accountable, right now in the Michigan legislature, the Republicans again empower, because they gerrymandered their districts to the point that despite losing the popular vote, they still retain control of both chambers. They are now trying to restrict the ability of the people of Michigan to have ballot referendums where the people can speak up and say, hey, we need to change that, for example, with the gerrymandering. So Prop 2 that just passed by huge margin, 61-39, it passed across Michigan. That's a ballot initiative they don't like because it's going to take away their the only power that they have in the state right now, which is through gerrymandering in the state government. And so they've passed a bill in the Michigan State Legislature in the House to make it much more difficult for citizens to get petitions on the ballot. Have you read about this? Do you know the details of it? There were like they want every congressional district, you can't get more than 15% of your signatures from any one congressional district. Is one of the big limitations. There are other limitations where they're trying to make people who are doing canvassing for signatures make them register with the state and have to wear a badge that says that they're paid. Mm-hmm. These are just intimidation tactics and bureaucratic red tape that they're trying to put it that the supposedly elected to serve the people legislature is trying to impose on the people so that the people can't make their own decisions. It's just another example of Republicans and conservatives not being interested in good government, not being interested in democracy, unless they can directly benefit it from it financially or through political power.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a problem that has been going on the last couple of cycles, especially with the ballot proposals within the GOP, is just the rhetoric of it. I remember seeing a campaign advertisement that says, if you vote yes on Prop 2, the liberal joke is on you. And that was the rhyme that they used. And I guess it worked because it was a rhyme and it was memorable.
Well, it didn't work because they lost.
It didn't have substance. It was good advertising because I remember it even after the election.
Sure.
But they didn't make any mention of improvements. They didn't say that this would be a better alternative in technology. They didn't really quantify and address to citizens the fears of what if this is capable of corruption, or what if this could make the system worse in this way. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the main critique that I would have with the entire lame duck session, is mm-hmm. that it's conservative without a purpose. It's not mm-hmm. saying that this is better. It's not saying that the new ballot proposal could be worse. It is just saying that this is the way that things are. Mm-hmm. And that is its own justification.
Right. Right. And it's really making things worse, because the whole thing about you may not get more than 15% of your signatures from any one congressional district. Well, there are the point of getting things on the ballot is so that everyone can vote on them. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it shouldn't. You put things. If you want to, a citizens group wants to put something on the ballot. It's not necessarily because they're claiming that there are people all over the state that want it. They're claiming they want to give people all over the state the opportunity to vote on it. Mm-hmm. Okay, and what the Republican legislature is trying to do is they're trying to prevent people from being able to ask their neighbors, do you want this to be the case in the state? They want to put more of that burden on activists who want to ask for, hey, let's pass this initiative. You can't even get to that stage until you canvass the whole state in a way that that makes it really difficult.
Yeah, and it slows down the process, and it's, and I don't think it's even a question of is it balancing out citizens with different amounts of concerns more than it is a rather direct attack on areas with more populated concentrations, especially right. in Michigan.
Sure.
Just looking at Wayne County and Ingham County, mm-hmm. Grand Rapids, Lansing, Detroit, mm-hmm. Flint.
Right.
Midland, Saginaw, that's
right.
a huge percentage of the state's population. And
right.
so to effectively devalue their voting power for ballot proposals, they don't do it in the name of balance. I haven't heard a single Republican, I haven't heard a single advertisement or editorial mm-hmm. Mention that it's about making sure that farmers in the Upper Peninsula or farmers, north of the thumb mm-hmm. have a say on this,
right.
because it's not ballot proposals about agriculture.
Right.
It's ballot proposals about social welfare, and it's
right.
ballot proposals about participation. Yeah.
Right. So it's more evidence that the party that always has the rhetoric of the Constitution and freedom and democracy doesn't actually value or care about any of those things. And it's just really, it should really, I mean, I've been saying this since the 80s because I've been looking at what they've been doing. And it's not just on the Republican side. Democrats have often been complicit in anti-democratic provisions.
Like the Patriot Act?
Like the Patriot Act.
Okay.
You know, sure. But many others. I mean, you know, when was the last, up until recently, how much rhetoric have you heard from the Democrats about getting rid of the Electoral College, for example?
I remember nothing before I heard America First.
Sure. It's a continuing problem of getting people to pay attention to what the results are rather than what their rhetoric is, because their rhetoric says, oh, we're doing this to help this and to help that, and really what it is to suppress the vote, to prevent people from being able to from being able to participate in a meaningful way in their democracy, unless they have enough money to fill somebody's coffers. And that's a real problem in America that we need to address at every level. And I'm sure we're going to continue talking about it on the show forever, because that's one of the things we're going to be doing the rest of our lives. Any other stories you want to talk about here on the news section?
No, I think that it's been a very interesting year. I'm excited to see the next couple of months, especially Michigan's new legislature, the next Congress. And I think that a lot of it is just, unfortunately, we're in that lull between the election cycle and really being able to, you know, put new fire to new feet.
Right, right. And that's an important piece of it, because we're going to have to put fire to Democratic feet. And that's often a problem in the party, because there are some people in the party that don't like it when you hold Democrats' feet to the fire. They get all upset about, well, you know, then it's going to be harder for them to get reelected next time. Well, that's how democracy works. You have you elect a representative, you hold their feet to the fire, and if they do stuff that makes it harder for them to get elected next cycle, it's because they did stuff that made it harder for them to get elected next cycle. But if we're going to have a democracy, the people have to be able to speak up and hold their politicians' feet to the fire, regardless of the party. So, we're going to segue into our discussion with Ryan Basor. I mentioned he's a cannabis activist and one of the Okemo 7. He's going to talk about his experiences and with the whole Okemo 7 situation and what the cannabis laws are now in Michigan after December 6th, when we had Legalization Day, and what exactly that means, and then what he sees going forward with the new Democratic leaders coming into the governor's office and the attorney general's office, particularly. Ryan Basor, thank you so much for being on the program today. You're a marijuana activist going back a long time now, and perhaps someone with a little bit more skin in the game over the course of this struggle than most, as you're one of the Okemo 7. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of people that don't really know what that is. So if you'd tell us that story as, you know, a basis of where we've been, and we can talk about then where we're at and where we're going.
I will. So in 2008, we passed the medical law. And currently, at that time, I became one of the first patients, a caregiver, started growing in my house. And at the time, I owned part of an insurance agency and was an insurance agent for contractors. And it was sucking my soul. I was doing really well, and it was, I hated it. I knew it was the one what I wanted out of life. And pretty soon the Holder memo came out, and Obama stated he would not go after, you know, medical for legal states. At that time, Colorado kind of exploded. Mm-hmm. And then in late 2009, I got the plans in order to open up Capital City Caregivers in Michigan mm-hmm. Avenue in Lansing. It was the second one in town. Next to Danny Trevino, Hydro Road, he was first. We were right on Michigan Avenue, mm-hmm. which eventually became the Green Mile. We ended up with 13 mm-hmm. Stores open in 2010, and I welcomed all of them because it was a you know, I felt like I wanted extra protection, and I wanted the industry to thrive.
Sure.
I opened that store, had a growth store up top, and I met up with Lance and Dennis Forsberg, an Okemos, and they had three properties they're looking to get leased. Mm-hmm. And we formed an LLC. We want to be above board. So we formed an LLC, and we leased each property, separate buildings, to mm-hmm. individual caregiver. And we had them pay rents. And we ended up having the state police walk through. Mm-hmm. We got police chief David Hall's okay. And then even talked with Dunnings and said, mm-hmm. we are good. So at that point, we went rocking, and we were growing there. We ended up having a big harvest. I got really involved politically at that time during that summer, against Schuette. Stop Schuette signs were all over the place.
So this was which summer?
This was the summer 2010, before the election. Schuette came in, and he was facing David Layton.
Right.
We raised a lot of money for David Layton, pushed really hard. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. that was the year that really changed Michigan forever, that election. Mm-hmm. We're getting it back. So I just got really politically involved. I was one of the first members of Cannabis Patients United. It was a group of attorneys and mostly attorneys, but then a couple marijuana people. And we went up, and I was part of a Rep Derhal's group with, at the time, it was Granholm. Mm-hmm. And got involved with that, and then also formed the MAC, Michigan Association of Compassion Centers, and I ended up went around the state recruiting other dispensaries. I got up to 50, and mm-hmm. it'd be $1,000 a month. So all of a sudden, we had all this money to fight the cases, because Schuette was going to come in and try to tear apart the voter initiated law. So Thanksgiving of 2010 hit. Was wonderful. Just started that. It was like a day I started dating my now fiance this mm-hmm. 8 years ago, and then 2 days later I got a call that we were being raided, and I drove out there freaked out driving around, and they called in, and actually this was part of the case that was a big deal. Probably saved me more time, is that Jennifer Granholm approved the National Guard military to come in on us. So they brought Black Hawk helicopters, full troops,
wow,
out of the sky, and smoke bombed the place. After I'd known that they were coming, my cousin, as an attorney, was at a vet in Williamson. The kids and the DEA agent on the case, their kids played soccer together, and the DA agent lost his temper with my cousin and said, basically told him they were watching, and he called me back, and I started calling authorities. Hey, we know you're watching. Please don't come in and steal our stuff. We're approved. Mm-hmm. So they raided it, took it all. It was pretty wild, just that whole scene. And then it went silent for 2 years. But among those 2 years, I had helicopters over my house every day. One time I had a Chinook twice. And it just circled, the one time it circled my house for like a half hour, just boom, 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 mm-hmm. boom, out in the middle of the country, middle mm-hmm. of nowhere in Fowlerville. And my fiance get fouled. I get pulled over all the time, get shaken down. It was nasty. And then we were waiting for Obama's pick to become the Western District U.S. Attorney, mm-hmm. USSA, whatever it is. And that time, we finally got it. It was Pat Miles Jr. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's Black dude from the West Side and went to school with Obama. We're like, great, we can go to him. We followed Obama's policies. He's just going to let us know that the case is dropped. So my attorneys went to him, and Pat Miles Jr. reaction was like, no, this is a big case for me politically. It's going to like basically give him, mm-hmm. you know, political gain, and mm-hmm. he's going to use that. And he indicted myself, my father-in-law, my brother-in-law, Dennis and Lance Forsberg, a guy named Doug Frakes, and then Pat Karslick. So at that time, Pat Karslick, who was a big wrestler at Michigan State and owned a Wheeler dealer, he ran right in and told on all of us, mm-hmm. and the rest of us stuck together. And I ended up, at the time, I had about $300,000 in my savings from insurance, and I ended up spending like all of it, just thinking I was going to win the case. So put a lot of pressure. There's a lot more into that. But what ended up happening is, at the federal system, I didn't know that if you're your first drug charge, if you plead guilty, you get an average of 4 years. Same mm-hmm. thing, if you fight it, take it to trial, your average time is 15 years. Mm-hmm. So there's it's just such crazy learning about how especially the federal court system, because the judge is just a part of the fucking prosecution. Mm-hmm. So I ended up, everyone ended up pleading guilty. I was the last holdout. They wanted me to rat on everybody I knew in the marijuana world, and that wasn't going to happen. And the last straw was when they were going to indict my fiance. Mm-hmm. They put that much pressure on me. Mm-hmm. Still messes me up, but. So I pled guilty, got 4 years, and then, leading up to it, I had about 4 or 5 months before I was going to go in. Went back, finished my degree from Northwood, management marketing. And then, I found out because you're not supposed to drink or you can't smoke. So I pretended I was a lawyer, called up the reality counseling service to find out what I was getting tested for, and found out that they didn't test me for benzos. So, for the last 3 months, it was, pretty much popping Xanax and then, grabbing a bunch of food on the way home after working and drinking a six pack of really happy beer. And I ended up gaining about 20, 30 pounds those last 3 months. And then ended up, checking in the prison. I got the self report down in Morgantown, West Virginia. Lance and I went in the same day. And, I ended up, I had 4 years. I ended up doing 2.5 because we were able to do the behavior modification, RDAP. They call it a drug program, but it's like 2% about drugs. It's all about behavior. Mm-hmm. And I got a year off of that. But that was like a bad girls club meets Survivor meets Real World. I was in there with a U.S. senator, drug kingpins, and there's 100 of you. They live together. You have these chains going around. And if you can hold each other accountable for grandiosity, power orientation, that's mm-hmm. this huge mix. But I ended up making it through the whole program. I was the only one ever with no issues, they call it. Mm-hmm. But I ran the supply closet, mm-hmm. and how you cooked it in there's not microwaves, it's 190 degrees, so you fill up the trash bags, and that's how you cook. So I control the trash bags instead of...
So I'm going to explain that. How do you cook with a trash bag?
You put 190 degree water in it, and mm-hmm. put it in maybe in a Tupperware that we had together, or you put it on top of it. There's some pretty incredible meals with stuff being stolen out of the kitchen, the food. Uh-huh. And, I had control of that. So instead of making people pay for it, which I could get trouble for, I just handed it out to the head of the Cubans, the head of the whites, head of the blacks, all that. Mm-hmm. And they were cool. They leave Besor alone. And mm-hmm. I was allowed to take naps, even though you're not supposed to. You're supposed to be, this is real. This is not like normal jail inside this little unit. You're under mm-hmm. all these rules. So mm-hmm. made it through that. I was part of the Native American group. My buddy, I grew up in Dansville, and, my best friend was doing 11 years there, and I happened to go there, and he's second in command of the Native American group. They took me right in, and I was doing sweat lodges the whole time I was there. It was intense, and mm-hmm. got in great shape, and lucky enough to have a lot of friends and marijuana people come visit me, and my fiance stuck by me, and ended up getting out, halfway house in Kalamazoo. They made me, and then home release, home confinement for 6 months, they made me live with my parents. And then I, ended up, then they made me live in an apartment, but I ended up on January 2017, I was supposed to have 8 years of paper, which is the tail, and, probation. And they let me go after a year with an apology, even like, hey, sorry about that. Mm-hmm. So that's when, that was pretty much push over. I was still the PTSD. I went right back and got my medical marijuana card, but I got my condition now is PTSD from the federal government.
Right.
So that's official. I'm probably one of the only. I made a point of that. And then luckily now everyone's back off probation. My brother-in-law, Kyle, he just got off last week. He did 4 years of the probation. He went to a medium, almost to a penitentiary, because he was young. That's the stuff on TV. It's the bad stuff. So, there's plenty of bad stuff where I was at too. But, besides that, and then, in the meantime, I had gotten back into, right when I got out, I was in marijuana activism again. I was secretly working with MI Legal Eyes and, mm-hmm. was all over that. And, when I went into prison, my idea was I'm going to get as much information as I can for the drug. Our side of it and come back out and be able to make some changes and in the meantime. And then I got the call from my buddy Michael Camorn, he's a lawyer, and said that Pat Miles Jr. was running for AG and already had the UAW support and Black Caucus support, and that it was he's not looking good for it. And it freaked me out. I was like, that's the same. We're gonna legalize, we're not gonna let this asshole that put me in federal prison. Mm-hmm. win the election. So then I
so let's just to go back on that, because I just want to clarify. So at the time that you were that they were watching you, it was legal. What you were doing was legal in Michigan.
Yes.
And the Obama administration had specifically said that they would respect the state's laws,
yes,
even though the federal law conflicted with that. They were going to use their prosecutorial discretion, because that's the option that they have,
yes,
to not prosecute folks who were complying with state law, even on the medical marijuana stuff. Even if they were violating federal law, okay, and then Obama appoints Patrick Miles Jr. to be the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Michigan, and he just goes against that policy and says, "I don't care that you're following Michigan law, and I'm going to prosecute you under the federal law," even though the president had said that
yes,
his Justice Department, which Miles was working for at the time, isn't going to do that.
Yep.
And that was the circumstance under which you decided to go and do the project that you did, right?
Yeah, I waited, and then I heard that, and I saw the opportunity, and,
sure,
and you know, I forgot to say, once Pat went in there, they immediately raided my house. They couldn't get a federal warrant, so they got it, because it was my property butted up. It was right on the line of the eastern and western districts. Mm-hmm. I was in the eastern, so they had to get a county warrant. They came in hard on me again, mm-hmm, in my house, mm-hmm, real hard on me. I mean, just you know, you look down and you're just covered in red dots. You know, you're sitting there. It's
right.
And they took my cars, got them back though. So on the case, what happened is they thought we were doing, I was really politically active, they thought we were doing crazy stuff, but we were growing 72 plants, the caregivers were, in 55-gallon drums,
sure,
one plant. It was still legal, so they raided, and in the middle of the night, they raided all the spots, they didn't have enough, they went and got warrants in the middle of the night to try to get people's homes to see if they get it. So what they ended up doing at one of at Lance's home, he had his book, the LLC book, because it was professional, stating, you know, articles of incorporation, everything. They took that. So what they came back and indicted on us on was conspiracy to manufacture marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And the conspiracy is because we were the landlords of these caregivers. We were conspiring. So literally, and then the Robacher-Farr, I always pronounce it wrong, amendment came out in 2014 in Congress, and that defunded the DEA and legal medical states to $1. And that's when all the federal stuff stopped. It happened when I was in prison.
Mm-hmm.
But on the way out to prison, I put together, me and Jeff Hank did the Charter Amendment in Lansing, and decriminalized. And my going away party, Bob Baldori, the Woolies played at. It was at the Avenue. It was a good time. It raised about $5,000-$6,000, and that's where I used to collect the signatures. So when I was in prison, waiting for breakfast one morning, I see CNN come across and saying, you know, and it came right across Lansing, decriminalized. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, so I just want to, one other thing. So did Miles actually said to people that the reason he was doing it is because this was good for him politically?
Yes. For his career.
Right.
Isn't that, yeah, karma's a bitch.
The willingness to abuse, the position and power of a public official like that, of a public position like that, it's just revolting. The funny thing is, you know, you see the same kind of thing with the lame duck in the Michigan State House right now.
Yep.
Where
Prop 1 made it, but all the other shit that they're doing.
Yeah, Prop 1, because it was an amendment, you know, so they need a constitutional amendment,
yeah,
so they needed a supermajority, and they didn't have the votes to really hurt it. So,
yeah.
So that's good news. But let's actually talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
What's the, you know, so you're really involved in this, and I know a lot of people are confused, like after the election, after November 6th, there were people like going, okay, it's legal now.
Lighting up in Little Caesars.
Right, right. But actually, it wasn't legal until 10 days after they certified the vote. Yep. So it actually became legal. Legalization Day, Michigan, was
December 6th.
December 6th,
we have now have two 420 dates in Michigan to celebrate now every year.
Right. November and December.
Well, no, April 20th, and I will separate, celebrate December 6th.
Oh, I got you. April 20th. Yeah. I see. Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. No, cool. Very cool. So we had this big discussion. People were confused. It's legal now. Yeah. No, it's not until December 6th. So now December 6th is passed.
Yes.
It was a great, a whole bunch of parties all across the state that were really cool. So my question is right now, what are the things that people can do now that they couldn't do before? That's legal now that wasn't legal before. And then we can talk about, you know, what we've got for the future. So what's the status?
It's basically every year, if you're adult, 21 and up, you can grow 12 plants at your home, inside, or if it's outside, it's to be determined, but to be safe, locked, enclosed in a fence, or cannot be seen from any neighbors.
So if you can see it, you have to make sure that it's all locked.
Yeah.
Nobody can get in, and if it's not locked, it has to be concealed so people can't see.
Right. And there's people, and there's going to be townships and municipalities pushing back and forth on that. That's the gist of that. Now, you're allowed to have 2.5 ounces as an adult on you in public, and at home, you're allowed to have 10 ounces. As long as it's properly stored. Now, the cool thing is, which Pam, Ken Stecker, the Prosecuting Association of Michigan, which he's been spreading misinformation for the last 10 years, started meetings back in 2010, I was in with him. He's trying to say, in the law, and it's the way the law is written, anything that you grow yourself, so if you got 12 plants and you grow 12 pounds, you can keep that 12 pounds. That's the law. They're trying to say you can't, that is it right now. And I believe our next attorney general is going to come out with a little bit of a white paper explaining some of that. Besides that, you can't smoke in public, but you can smoke on private property. So right now, you could have a little private club and invite people there, and you could be smoking, social use. It's totally cool. You can't sell it to anybody, but you can gift it to them right now, and up to 2.5 ounces. So that's great too. You can smoke a joint on your property, front porch.
Okay.
It's your business, back porch. You're allowed to do that. Now, there might be some pushback, maybe a nuisance complaint from a neighbor taking it to, you know, your city council, whatever, but it's not, the police aren't coming on it. The coolest thing is that marijuana smell is no longer probable cause for the cops either. Mm. And that's a big deal for especially the poorer communities, in the inner cities, whatever race you are, the lower class, and you're driving a crappy car, they're going to say, oh, I smell something. And even if you have it or not, now they're screwing with it. You can't do that anymore. Now, the burnt smell, you'd have to almost admit to. Obviously, you can't smoke and drive. You're not supposed to drive stone. And there's so if anyone's listening, do not consent to a THC type breathalyzer or anything like that they're trying to do. You do not have to at all. The only thing that the only way they can find out if what's in your system if they get a warrant and draw blood. That's it.
I don't know a lot about this. But what I've heard is that one of the issues with the THC breathalyzers is that there's no evidence that they're actually accurate.
Right. There's not. It's junk science.
Okay. So there's
it's Republican
so
that's, junk science.
Right.
And,
right.
You know,
right.
Senator Jones and his whole crew.
Right.
Would being glassed over in the eyes and having the munchies be probable cause still if a smell is no longer? It's a legitimate question, I think, because there are a lot of gray areas.
No, it's not. You are allowed to be stoned. I mean, now people are going to get tricked into admitting it. So if you're driving around, when's the last time you smoked? That was like 30 minutes ago. All right, get out of the car.
Right.
I always told everyone with medical when you're asked because you have protections of that. I just say, you know what? I have my card, but I haven't had to use it in like 4 months because my pain's been good or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, just whatever. Just don't give them that. They try to trick you into that because they know it's a game.
Right. So I just want to go over that again. So it's okay. It's okay to smoke in view of the public as long as you're on private property.
Yep.
Okay.
I'm still having a little hard time getting used to.
Yeah.
But I like it.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, that's
still
that's
looking
really
over
cool.
my shoulder, you know?
understandable given, you know, what you've been through. So that's a key point that you made though about, you know, you can have 12 plants, and you can have however much you grow from that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that indefinite? I mean, it's not like it goes bad.
So if you got like 12 pounds vacuum sealed in your closet,
mm-hmm.
you know,
as long as you can, you know, say that you grew it yourself.
Yeah, and you don't tell on and don't tell on yourself.
Sure.
Not that I'm advocating for that, but.
Right, right. Well, you know. So, and otherwise, 10 ounces.
Yes.
Up to 10 ounces.
Yep. Okay. Yep. 2.5. You can have 2.5. And then the
equivalent. 2.5 on you in public.
Yeah. And the equivalency all the way down, like with the oils and the medibles, there's the chart. Right. They fall. I believe it's going to fall right in line with the medical.
Okay.
You know, equations.
Okay.
Which are pretty generous in my point. Okay. I think the amount of oil that someone's allowed to carry legally is pretty mm-hmm. incredible.
So, sure. I guess in terms of just expanding that conversation out further, some of the questions I had were, do those laws on quantities and locking, does that expand outwards into all hemp products? Does it have jurisdiction? I know that there was something about local municipalities and ordinances being able to work and further specify or be even more explicit and restrictive.
Now, it's a voter-initiated law, so I don't, and the way we always wrote it, you can't get more restrictive on certain aspects of it at the local level. We've been fighting that in courts, and we won every time. We lost the Court of Appeals every time, but we eventually won the Supreme Court. So I don't, and I'm not a lawyer, but I don't believe they can make it more restrictive. Now, what's going on in the rest of the law, everyone wants to know, is when can I go into a store and buy it?
Sure.
Well, that's coming. They have a year from December 6th, but if it was like the last administration, it would probably take that full year. This new one, they can get it going as soon as they want. And how it's going to work, the reason we had to do it this way, too, is we needed to get this funded. This was funded by a lot of marijuana people that were in business, and they were going for their medical licenses. So in the law, the first 2 years of the rec stores, the 5 licenses, all of them, go to people that already had the medical or have opted in for medical.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing, these municipalities that are getting all worked up saying they don't want it, saying they want the tax revenue. So medical tax is going away with rec. So, and under that law, for each one of the 5 licenses, the community shares that proportionally with the pie for the excise tax. Under the new law, medical, there is no medical tax, so that goes away. Rec, you share only by the number of provisioning centers you have and micro businesses. So mm-hmm. we're forcing these guys to do retail because some of these places we're dealing with, we'll let you grow it, but we'd hate to have all these, you know, medical patients come to our town and ruin it type stuff. Some backwards thinking.
Let me understand that a little bit more. So you're saying that the way that the law is written, local governments get more tax revenue the more retail places they the more
yes.
micro businesses and the more retail recreational retail
yep.
Shops they have, and that's different than it used to be because they could get a share of the total revenue from the state
yep.
and it didn't matter necessarily how many were in there.
Say I'm out in Mason and Mason now says, you know what, we really like growers and processors, but we don't want all these stoners coming to our town, so we're not gonna, you know, we're gonna let John, who owns a farm, and make money doing this.
Mm-hmm.
There's 3 licenses out there. They're out of the whole portion. Say there's this huge pie.
Mm-hmm.
They take it and divide the number of licenses in the state, and so for that 3, they get an even amount.
Mm-hmm.
Under the new one, it's going to be the same pie, but it's going to be divided into all the provisioning centers and the micro businesses.
Okay, so municipalities can't just say, okay, you can grow it here, but you can't sell it here and still get the tax revenue.
Right.
In order to get the tax revenue, they have to say, you know, this is fully legal now,
yeah.
and it's fully legal everywhere. And if we don't do that, we don't get the tax
yep.
revenue.
And one of the cool things is on these micro businesses we put in, because I really believe we have the best legalization law mm-hmm. in the world. I mean, it does let big people come in and be profitable, but it also lets the little guy get involved. And that was the problem with the last one. So this micro license is, you can be vertically integrated in your own little spot.
Mm-hmm.
It's 150 plants. You can process it, which
mm-hmm.
make your oils, wax, whatever. And then you can also sell it,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty cool. And for that, I see, you know, it's going to be hard work. You're going to be good at it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a way also for somebody to, you know, make 6 figures, loving what they're doing. But I do see if you have such a great brand, I do eventually see if somebody wanted to, like some mm-hmm. one of these big companies,
mm-hmm.
MedMen or Harvest, whatever,
mm-hmm.
be like, we really like that. You know, just with the craft beer, you see Shorts got bought partially by Leinenkugel or something like that. Yeah, it was Leinenkugel. They want those brands to stay the same. So there's an opportunity for people with a big upside, even with the micro businesses. Mm-hmm. Now, what's going on now, I don't know if you want to get into what's really going on Prop 1, who's behind trying to get rid of this.
Well, I do want to get into that, but I want to ask, I want to make another point about that. One of the key reasons that it's important to have home grow and micro business, mm-hmm. both of those two different things, is because really big business is looking at this as a huge revenue stream, mm-hmm. and they would like nothing more than to have really big barriers in front of people, so that they, you know, those are barriers that they have teams of lawyers, they can get through all of the application processes, and they have the money to pay high licensing fees and all of that kind of stuff. And so if we didn't have these micro businesses and the home grow mm-hmm. provision, then they could control the supply, and as a result, they would actually control the price a lot. Mm-hmm. So the fact that we have home grow and micro businesses, so two different levels of that, means that the people can decide what the price is by growing it themselves. If big business is too much, and you can have a small business without having to have a massive investment. Like, for example, I'm not sure what the rules are coming in, but when we were looking at them earlier, to have a liquor store, you have to have like $50,000 invested or something mm-hmm. like that. And for a marijuana establishment, they were talking about $300,000.
Yeah, $300,000 for retail, and then even for the Class C, it's like $500,000. And it has to be 25% liquid. I mean, there's huge,
right? Which is a barrier to entry for small business.
And that's actually lower than most of the other states. You take Florida, passed a law, voted it in. They don't have 10 years of activists. They don't have 10 people inside fighting and all these relationships. Michigan, I mean, they did everything they could to rip gut everything, and we fought them every step of the way to keep it the way it is. It's actually all these other states that feel bad that they don't have our 10 years of learning the game and the system, and they come in and they get run over. We were actually able to hold them off. We're very unique in that way. Mm-hmm. I think we're the last state mm-hmm. that's going to be able to hold off, you know, the big mm-hmm. guys coming in and making it out, because they don't want us to home grow and they don't want the micro businesses. But as you see, like, there's going to be good companies coming in, be able to produce good product and flour. But It's going to be a handful of them, because we're going to have these micros and the caregivers. That right now, Michigan is known for having great cannabis. Mm-hmm. I mean, we really do. Mm-hmm. I've traveled all over the country, and I mean, if you go into those stores, it doesn't compare. I'm sure they have their own system too. But we have that opportunity now, so.
And I'd say also great microbreweries. I mean,
of course.
I bring that up because, you know, all of the evidence shows that marijuana is, of course, much less of a problem than alcohol, both for an individual and for society. Mm-hmm. Freedom. You know, you get to put what you want in your body, and grow plants.
Not hurt anybody. Yeah, what a crazy concept.
Right.
So that's an interesting bit of interplay. So if I'm hearing you right, you're talking about how very large operations, they want to be able to control the process. They're able to pay the licensing fees, have that high barrier to entry. Mm-hmm. You're talking about the $300,000-$500,000 and the liquidation percentage. Plus you have, from the policy side, legislators, lawyers, Pat Miles and the like, making arguments, that seem like they could synergize together. Even if that were, behind closed doors, if that were kind of under the radar, and able to keep the money. Is that something that you've seen in terms of legislators and large, financial organizations working together in
we know who they are and all that. It's obvious. A lot of these Republican senators that are on the way out, they did 8 years in the House together, and they did 8 years in the Senate, and they've been pretty much untouchable. The last 8 years, you can do whatever you want. Bill Schuette's not going to slap you down. They're not going to investigate. I mean, unless you're a marijuana patient or mm-hmm. you're gay or something, then he's coming after you. So, there's a group of them. There's a guy named Steve Linder. He calls himself the Dark Prince of like the king of dark money, whatever, fundraiser, I forget is what he likes to call himself. They were all part of this, the MRC program, which was a group of pretty wealthy politicos that were trying to get it to where there's going to be 10 big rows, Ohio style. Mm-hmm. While we were doing MI legalized, they were coming at us with that. Mm-hmm. There's three petitions back in 16.
Right.
And those same people turned around and came up with a scheme. You know, Rick Johnson left his lobbying firm. Now he's on the board, and they have a whole scheme going on. And it's Manny Lentine's. He's a lobbyist. His clients are all the people like down in the big company down. Their clients aren't like the huge multi-state companies, because a lot of those guys I've been meeting them. They're really into cannabis. They've been doing it their whole lives. They've worked their way up. Some of these guys they're cool. Now, what you're seeing in Michigan is the local big guys companies. They don't care about marijuana. Some of them call people stoners, dumb hippies, and they could care less. They're only in it to make money. And that whole group is up there lobbying everything they can with Mikoff, pushing it to get rid of home grows and get rid of the micro businesses and make it harder at barrier of entry even than it already is. And they've spent millions against us and used all their tricks, but I mean, we've held them off every step of the way, which is, sure. You know, thinking about it, it's been at first it was David versus Goliath, but now come January 1st, all of a sudden we have more friends than they do in the politics, which we've never had. We're used to doing petitions with no money and, you know, like finding one politician, Jeff Irwin, that likes us. And sure. Then we needed a Republican, so we found Mike Collin and whatever, you know, and it was just one. And it's just, you know, mm-hmm. going to meeting. And now we literally learned under fire at war doing this. And mm-hmm. now we have those skills. Now we're going to have friends and give us about a year. We're going to have a lot of money too. So the whole, It's interesting what they created by going after us so hard, you know, and beating us down so hard, the Republicans.
Hey, thanks for listening. If you want to hear the final half of our conversation with Ryan, sign up to help support our show on Patreon. Your monthly contribution of $5 or more will give you access to bonus content like extended episodes and exclusive one-on-one interviews with special guests. Find us at patreon.com/Michigan Progressive. State of the Revolution is a production of Michigan Progressive. Our director and editor is Benjamin Klon. Our producers are Sam Pernick, Mara Zumberg, and Eric Kester. Our music is composed by Benjamin Klon. I'm Liano Sharon. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back with another episode soon.